Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 289 of the Roguecast, recorded March 3rd, 2020. I'm too weak to be my champ. We're back for another round.
All right. As we're doing this, it's election day. It's tense and exciting. And but we bring a bounty of comics to counterbalance reality with fantasy.
Nice, I like it.
I didn't know where I was going.
Me neither.
I thought I'd just see what happened.
It was a thrill ride.
Yeah.
It was
a journey itself.
It was like Uncut Gems, which we were just talking about off mic.
Yes.
Do we
all like Uncut Gems to varying stripes?
We all liked Uncut Gems. Nick is the latecomer. He's finally seen it.
And
Nick
is all like, I bought it on digital sight unseen.
Would you agree that like it was an Oscar, at least Oscar nomination worthy performance?
Yeah. Sandler did a great job.
I'd say so.
And honestly, I feel like the SATVs need to be recognized at some point.
Yeah, I was not aware of them until this, and I'm going to have to bounce back and check some of their previous movies. What's the one that everybody keeps mentioning?
Good Time.
Have they done others besides that?
They have done a couple of smaller films, but yeah.
Those are kind of their notable so far.
Those are the notable ones.
All right.
They did Fast and Furious 8, actually.
I think they've gone on record saying they're not going to do anything like that. Like,
but I would watch the SNL spoof trailer of how they would do it.
Yeah.
Of like a super coked up Vin Diesel or whatever, desperate to win this race. Yeah.
Yeah, I can see it.
All right, comics.
Yeah. So before we get all that, we are closed on Monday.
Yes.
For inventory.
Yes.
We are going to be here counting everything and going slowly mad.
Yes, if you do come up and press yourself, your face up against the window or door, well, A, we can't let you in, sorry. B, it's going to be like you're looking in at a cage. Like in one of those movies where they release some toxin that turns animals violent.
Yeah.
It'll be like that. All right, you know how it happened in...
How about Scarecrow releasing fear gas and we're just all nuts?
Sure. Remember, it happened in like Detective Pikachu, though.
That's true.
They released that spray that turns Pokemon nuts.
Yeah. Yes, if you come in on inventory day, we will all be merged with Pokemon. What Pokemon will you be merged with?
Bulbasaur.
Yeah, I knew you'd have an answer. Why would I think of it? You knew Bulbasaur is your spirit Pokemon.
That is correct.
I don't have a Pokemon. Nick, do you have a Pokemon?
I mean, Charizard is really cool.
Randy, of course, is Machop.
Not Machamp, which is like the biggest one.
Please.
I'm too
Machop
weak.
Is the tiny one.
I'm too weak to be Machamp.
Yes.
That took a turn.
This is weird. This is a weird one.
All right. So let's jump over to some news. There's a trailer that came out for Candyman, the remake that Jordan Peele's producing, and Nia Long, right?
Oh.
Who's the director?
Oh,
Y'all look that up.
Yeah.
I'm going to quick ask, has anyone here, because I know this is weird since I'm a horror movie fan, I've never seen the original Candyman. I've got a few friends who are saying you should see it, and I'm going to check it out sometime soon. Have either of y'all seen
Nia DaCosta?
Nia DaCosta. I have not.
I have not either, actually.
I'm not a big slasher movie fan in general.
Right. I feel like the vibe I get from people is that there's something a little bit more to this, and I don't know if it's just that I think he's like a sympathetic guy that like doesn't he get lynched or something horrible?
Yeah, and it's an urban legend, right? It's based on Bloody Mary and all that.
And Tony Todd plays.
I like Tony Todd. He's of course Worf's brother, Kern.
I have a funny anecdote. This is on Netflix right now. I put it in my queue because I'd in our queue at home, never seen it before.
Yep.
My wife took it out of the queue because she actually saw it and was terrified by it. So she's like, we cannot watch this.
Well, if you put it back in the queue again, Candyman will come to your house.
Actually, you have to do it five times.
Oh, it's five. It was three, wasn't it?
I think it was three.
You know, I thought so too, but in this new trailer, they say five times.
That's because in 2020, there's been inflation.
You know what I was thinking? Because I thought it was three originally, too, and that's the traditional Bloody Mary one. But I wondered if they made it to, like, five times. Because, like, if you do it three times, like, you can kind of just knock that out. But if you say it five times, I think you got to, like, really think, like, all right, you realize you're coming up to the precipice. And you're like, am I really going to say it that fifth time?
You know what's interesting?
Yeah.
So the urban legend, which I did a quick search, urban legend is based on Candyman once, twice, three times. But the 1992 film does say five times.
Okay. Huh. There we go.
It's like you really have to devote yourself to saying it that many times.
So yeah. here's what.
What if he had to say it 500?
Oh God!
Kidding me. By the way, I hit 5 in there, so
yeah.
I think I'm supposed to look in a mirror or something.
Yeah. I think that is the case.
Well, when you look in a mirror,
But I was like, maybe I misunderstood. Maybe it's 5,000 times.
So, I'm sure there's more to this, but I'm watching this, and there's a horror trope.
Yes,
and it's a trope that I remember also. Like Eddie Murphy commented on this. White people are dumb.
Oh yeah, sure.
Oh yeah.
And they will go and say Candyman 5 times in a mirror to see what happens, and then when someone shows up and murders them, you're like, yeah, you deserve that, white people.
That's not dumb. Magic is fake. Urban legends are fake. I would absolutely do it.
Yes, but in the horror movie, Dave, you'd be dumb.
But I don't. You don't. You don't know you're in a horror movie. In a horror movie,
you'd be the first one to die.
I probably would be. I'd be the skeptic who'd be like, "There's nothing here that can harm us." However,
my point being,
yeah, okay.
This is a remake that seems heavily African American.
Yes.
So you got to give me an explanation for why these African American people are acting like white people.
Well, he's like an artist. He's like a like.
Oh, that's right. So yeah, I hadn't. I'd kind of forgotten it from the trailer. It seems like he's like doing research into.
Well, he's like living in the kind of area where Candyman was supposed to have, like. Originated from basically where he originated from. Like I think it's like a candy factory or something.
Do we get the sense that they intend for the original movie to have events to have occurred and that this is a follow up to it?
I can't tell.
Yeah, I can't tell.
Or is it like a rethink of the whole concept?
And it wasn't just an original movie. It's like there's sequels and stuff.
Yeah,
too.
There were multiples. Right. I don't know, actually. I mean, I'm not even sure if, like, I've heard Tony Todd makes an appearance or something.
Was Tony Todd in the Final Destination movies?
He was.
He was, like, Death.
The incarnation of Death. I believe he was. Yeah. I mean, he's an iconic, his voice is, like, the scariest thing in all the world.
For sure.
So, this is interesting.
But wasn't Tony Todd also in the remake of Night of the Living Dead in, like, 1990?
Oh, it's possible.
I think he was, like, the lead guy. I'm not 100% sure on that, but I think so.
So, Candyman, the 1992 movie,
yes.
is based on a short story called The Forbidden by Clive Barker.
Oh.
What?
Follows a graduate student in Chicago completing a thesis on urban legends, which leads her to the legend of Candyman, the ghost of an artist and son of a slave who was murdered in the late 19th century.
So this is actually like a...
Well, it could be truer, although none of us having seen the original movie, maybe that was part of that one too?
And here's the original movie. The story, Barker's story revolves around themes of British class system in contemporary Liverpool. The director, Bernard Rose, decided to set it in Cabrini Green in Chicago, which is where... It seems like if it's not a continuation, this is a heavy remake, but I don't know.
It sounds interesting. Like, yeah, it's going to... Jordan Peele is producing, so I'm going to assume it maybe has a sharp social commentary. Certainly the movies he's made have had that. And it sounds like the original one possibly did, too, beyond just the thrill ride of,
Clive Barker story.
Do the people in the original one... I guess here's the biggest question in all slashers. Do the people deserve to die? Have they done something wrong? Or are they just gambling with an urban legend?
All people deserve to die.
I feel like it's a problem.
Thanks, Randy.
It's a little bit of
now from the nihilist corner.
I mean, the portion of this trailer that has the girls in like the bathroom of the high school felt very kind of Ringish.
Yeah, sure.
I actually thought it was very effective, like the one girl coming in last and... hearing all the other girls get killed.
Yeah.
And essentially
it's
being
pretty creepy.
Traumatized.
I'm trying to think. You see stuff with his art, too. It's like he's doing exhibits based on the iconography of it or something.
Well, and he's like the evoking kind of Candyman and wanting people to sort of revisit it or something. And
yeah.
Like one of his pieces of artwork is even like a mirror and says this with an image. And
like you're supposed to do it as part of the exhibit. Like it's interactive and all that.
Well, it's kind of cool. The actor in it is, if I'm not mistaken, the same actor who played Dr. Manhattan in The Watchmen.
Okay.
Is it really?
I'm pretty sure.
That guy was really good.
Patrick Wilson? No.
No, no, no. He's talking about the Watchmen TV show.
Oh, okay.
Yes. The current HBO.
Guy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, okay.
If I'm not mistaken.
I was very confused for a second.
No. If I'm not mistaken, that is the same actor.
Well, I'm looking it up.
I really like him.
Muscular.
Yahya Abdul-Mateen.
I really like him as an actor.
He's great.
Was fantastic in Watchmen. He's been in a couple of other things that have been great, too. So
I would say, despite the fact that this looks like it has like sort of the underlying structure, perhaps, of a slasher, there's probably going to be something a little bit more meat to this,
yeah.
And that interests me.
I want to see it. I don't know if I'll be able to see it. Kaylee will.
Yeah, this
like,
might be Nick. You and I might have to go catch it.
Yeah, we'll have to.
Let me ask, and like, I don't know what does anybody know what the deal is with the bees?
I don't.
Not the bees.
Candies, sugar.
I guess so. Like, I assume he died some horrible way. Like they, you know, like beat the hell out of him, and then like pour honey on him, and like bees devour him or something. But I don't know.
Did you guys know that the Yahya Abdul-Mateen was also Black Manta?
Yes. What? Yeah, he was an Aquaman.
Yep.
Man, this guy, he's kind of it's weird. He's like a genre actor, but who's like pretty really talented guy.
He also played Cadillac in The Get Down, like the pimp dude.
Oh, wow.
And he was great in that.
Huh. Okay. Man of many talents.
Yeah, man of many talents.
He built his Black Manta suit while listening to Depeche Mode.
And he was in The Greatest Showman.
The musical?
Musical. Yeah,
maybe he can sing too.
Yeah,
and I will say he's a handsome, muscular man.
It's true.
Ladies, gay guys, bi people, if you're looking for somebody, you may want to continue. May want to look into this guy.
That turned into a weird dating app for an actor, Dave. It's a weird direction for that to have gone.
I just thought I'd get like he may not be having any luck.
Yeah, it seems hard for a successful, good-looking actor.
Yeah, he's probably got money too, and you know, people are probably might find that unapproachable.
Yeah, right. good for you. Good looking out, Dave.
I just want to meet him.
All right, let's talk Baldur's Gate 3 cinematic trailer.
Nick, did you watch this?
I did.
This was cool as hell.
I thought it was cool, but I don't know if I'd say cool as hell. But it's pretty cool. What I wanted was more of like a sense of like what the how it interacts with what you the character will be doing in there. But let's say what happens in it because it is really a dope idea.
So it's a mind flayer who it shows up in his spell jammer and starts just.
Like, people don't know what a spell jammer is.
Yes, they do.
Russell does.
From what I understand, though, isn't that what's supposed to have happened at the end of Baldur's Gate? Is like the mind flayers of. Come and like overtaken the
it's
city.
Been 15.
Well, there was a trailer was a few end. Like a year or two ago that showed that happening, but I thought that was still like a lead into this, just
okay.
Like a prelude trailer that showed like an infection where all the people were becoming mind flayers.
I have never played any of Baldur's Gate games.
So here's the confusing thing for me: is like Baldur's Gate. There was a Baldur's Gate and a Baldur's Gate 2, and those were like computer games. Wasn't there also a Baldur's Gate that was like. On the PlayStation or something?
Or was that just the platform
for... That was the platform version of it, I guess. So Baldur's Gate 2, Shadows of Omn.
Yeah.
On Wikipedia. It was BioWare. It was September 2000, so 20 years ago.
Wow.
Good lord. Yeah, but that was one of the ones, of course, that put BioWare on the map.
Yep.
Later they would go on to make Dragon Age, Mass Effect, etc., etc. Knights of the Old Republic.
It's all to do with Baal, the god of murder.
Hmm.
And elves... And Underdark, but
no mind flayers.
I don't see a mind flayer. I remember fighting beholders at some point.
All right,
but I believe this is a new story.
Well, this
so
is...
let's quick finish the description. You have a mind flayer, aka the tentacled nasties, which are some of the best, the nastiest boss kind of monster humanoids in
D&D.
They
eat your brains.
Yeah, they eat your brains. They're super smart and wily, dangerous master villains. He's like flying through the air in this airship, which Randy identifies as a spelljammer.
Spelljammer.
Are we 100% sure about that?
Correct. Yes.
Is spelljammer a type of ship or is it a specific ship?
It is a type of ship.
Type of ship that's
they are space going.
Yes, and in the 80s, this was like, you could travel between different like D&D worlds by going through the ether of space.
And they had different designs, like the elven ones were very pretty and looking. Yeah. The Mind Flayers had sort of an aquatic, squid-looking design.
Yep.
They were very well-designed ships.
And this one is like a giant squiddy one with its... Then it has its own like sort of long tentacles and stuff reaching out in front of it.
Yeah, the tentacles reach...
It's like an organic ship.
And he has this cool thing that he like twangs, like a guitar string thing that makes it teleport.
Oh, right.
And it like and it appears above like a city, maybe Baldur's Gate, and the little tentacles start going out and it looks like they're disintegrating people, but they're actually bringing them aboard the ship so he can like put his little Mind Flayer larva in them. It's creepy.
Yeah.
And
oh,
terrible.
That's right. You see it crawling through somebody's eye... And the rest of the trailer is him being pursued by what looks like dragons with humans mounted on them.
Were they
that
humans
are chasing
or were they Gith?
Oh,
they're Gith.
Yeah, which are what?
Githyanki
or Githzerai?
Good guys, bad guys?
Yes.
All right. What's interesting is, like, I can't tell what, like, you know, like, Mind Flayer is pretty much always evil.
Yeah.
And but they are pursuing him on dragons. They're like, dragons are breathing fire and attacking the thing. And do they eventually bring it down at the end of the trailer?
No.
I feel like
no, teleports away.
Teleports away. Okay, right.
But it was cool.
One of the people gets away, yeah.
But it was cool that the dragons could follow, like, the interdimensional, like, teleportation kind
yeah.
of things.
It's what would be, like, a... Like, if you were as a player experiencing this, I would assume that you are level, like, 15 or above or something like
yeah.
that. Like, you are a high-level player. But presumably this is backstory stuff for, like, what's going on in there, which is going to have some kind of, like, Mind Flayer invasion
yeah.
or something like that.
It was a great cutscene.
Yeah, the CG was, of course, really high-level stuff in it.
I mean, I
big dramatic. It's a big dramatic chase.
I docked a few points because there was no Minsk or Boo.
Yeah, that's true.
If they had been involved, it would have been, like, taken it to that next level.
It wouldn't... I don't think it would have worked here. I think you kind of need this to be its own self. This is the thing, I think... I didn't need to know what the story is. This was just a cool, like, cinematic thing.
Yeah.
Well, I do think it's going to be part of the story.
It is, and that's the thing. I know it. I do know a fair amount about this kind of stuff. I know what the Githzerai are. I know what a Spelljammer is. I know the Mind Flayers. But I don't know how it all connects. Like, when we were talking about this in the chat, Anna clearly knows more about this than I do. Like, she's talking about it, and she knows some of the lore and some of these things, and I was maybe putting together what was actually going on, and I'm like...
No.
I actually didn't care what was going on. I just saw cool guys riding dragons attacking a Mind Flayer in a big old ship.
It's D&D is... Fast and the Furious.
Yes. And I we don't see this kind of stuff that
can,
often.
Can we see this in, like, live action form for the actual D&D movie that
no, you get only trash.
I don't want it. I want a CGI movie of just this. I want this to be a full-on movie.
Yeah, I mean, that would be great. I would take that, but I would also take... They're doing a D&D movie.
Are they? Doing
yeah,
another one?
They're doing another one.
I'm sure it'll be
you
great.
Know what I would like for it to be? I would like for it to make me be... I'd like to be as pleasantly surprised by it as I was with the Color Out of Space movie.
I still need to watch that.
Where it's like, it's not perfect, but I was like, it got... Like Lovecraft, much, much more right than I expected it to,
yeah.
and still had a modern sensibility and everything. If they could find whatever that thing is for D&D, I'd be pretty happy.
Yep. I honestly don't know when this is coming out or anything. I'm not.
Are you gonna buy it like day one?
I'll get the game for sure, but I don't play video games through. Like, I haven't played the Star Wars one that came out. I played the first, I don't know, 45 minutes, an hour of it. Really enjoyed it. Haven't gotten back to it. I don't have the attention span for long-form video games anymore.
It's also... I could also point out another thing. So much damn television to watch.
Exactly. Way too much TV to watch.
I would play it, but I need something like the action in it to be somewhat more turn-based. And not real-time where I'm...
But that's your thing. That's what you love about, like, the Final Fantasy games and
yep.
things like that.
Yep. But it also goes back to actually the very earliest D&D games I played, which were games like Pool of Radiance, and then Curse of the Azure Bonds was the next big one. Those ones took place as turn-based games.
Okay.
Yeah.
I never played any of the D&D games,
yep.
so I didn't...
Yeah, they used, like, second edition rules, if I'm not mistaken. And, like, I remember when you would go down, like, into a dungeon or something, it actually changed to a very primitive, like, first-person view
yep.
where you would just, like, hit a button for forward, and you would just, like, it would just jump to the next thing. It wasn't animated. You would just, like, be 10 feet further down. It'd be, like,
yeah.
moving further down. And then, like, you know, a little goblin would pop up indicating, like, a combat with some goblins. But it could, and then that you would get that isometric sort of Diablo-style thing, only, again, not in real time. And you would have these, like, crazy epic battles. There could be, like, 100 goblins and a few trolls and things
That's
like that.
Cool.
But, yeah, you would sort of have the time to play it. I remember even then, you could set the computer to, like, kind of run AI for your allies or, like, for anybody in the party, I think. Even this is, like, in the, late 80s or something.
I think, Dave, with everyone having been playing, like, WoW and that kind of stuff where you've mm-hmm. got... Your character has, like, 15 different options, and you apply it all real... And so it's basically like you've got a group of people,
yeah.
and everybody's applying. So you do get the sort of, like, the wizard's throwing spells, and the fire's
yep.
attacking, and you get it all in real time. I think a lot of people have moved on to a point where, like, that's a skill set they all have, and that's what they want.
Yeah, I can see it. I mean, you know, like, there's, you know, games that BioWare has made, like Mass Effect,
yep.
Where they did a pretty good job of that stuff. But yeah, I kind of like what I missed and what I liked about those early D&D ones was, like, you know, I would choose what spell the wizard was gonna do, and then I would, like, you know, drop it, and you'd have like a little spell template. I'd figure out where I wanted it to go. I'd see it, and I'd get the satisfaction of playing as the wizard, and then I'd do the turn as the rogue and maneuver him around behind the other people. And instead, what you're doing in a game like Mass Effect or Dragon Age is you're moving one guy, and just chaos is happening around you.
Yeah.
Everything is exploding and all this, and it is kind of neat in a different way. I just know of the two, I prefer the turn-based thing.
Well, what's interesting is that your preference is very similar to how D&D as an RPG works.
Right.
Like, everybody is like, I know exactly where my fireball stops.
Right.
And, like, we're all making plans, and, like, and everybody's... It feels much more true to D&D, which is interesting. That doesn't translate into the...
That spell stuff, you don't have to think about it. But yes, I would be surprised if they did turn-based. Usually they do some sort of modified thing, a pausable real-time... but I'm going to for sure have my eye on it. I would like to play a D&D game with some depth and stuff to it. Probably not like 80 hours of depth. I'd be happy with a good 40. Yeah. But, you know.
We got some... This is news so much, but Jim Lee is kind of making noises like DC's not planning to replace DanDio.
No.
Last week we talked a lot about DanDio being gone and what that's going to mean. And if it's just that DanDio left... Is it still a big change at DC? I feel like it still is. Like, DiDio was clearly micromanaging a lot of stuff, and it might change direction, but it might just basically be formless and less...
I'm a little worried. Like, clearly, Jim Lee has some good instincts, but you're also, like, saying, like, the guy who's running the show is the creator of Wildcats.
Yep.
Honestly, and I'm talking out of my ass, I don't know, but I feel like Dan DiDio was the guy... doing everything. And Jim Lee was a little bit off to the side, handling, like, the video game things and stuff like that.
That's the sense I get, too.
And DiDio was so micromanaging. I think Jim Lee's just going to burn out. I can't see him doing this long.
He does not want to do this particular side of the job.
Right. Yeah, you know, I don't think that's him.
I'll say this, like... DiDio did a lot of things that, like, we have not liked, but fewer that you didn't like. But also, like, we have to, like, kind of credit him for, like, a lot of the successes, whether it's overseeing, like, a lot of Geoff Johns' successes, you know, on Flash and Green Lantern and all those books, or,
well, Tom King stuff. I mean, you got to give him credit for
Tom King stuff. Yeah.
As much as he rough.
Basically, yeah. Anything that we've liked in like the last 15 years has also been him. It's just that I know it's been fewer and far between for you and me, especially Randy.
Yeah, yeah. He made DC successful for some people.
Yeah.
I wonder. Jim Lee seems like he's like, usually when I hear him pop up, and I know behind the scenes he must be doing more, but he's almost like he's doing art director type stuff too. Yeah. Like he would, you know, do redesigns on all of the New 52 costumes and stuff like that.
Right.
So you know, I almost feel like sort of maybe some big picture stuff and aesthetics and stuff like that. I always felt like they were kind of coming from him. But yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting notion, and you might be right, Nick. Is that he may kind of burn out on that the new workload.
Yeah. I, you know, how I feel about Jim Lee is not anything. I just, like, I don't know if he's going to be cut out to do sole editor-in-chief.
Yeah. On the other hand, he has been at this a while at this point. And,
sure.
You know, who knows what all skills he's picked up. He may be doing more behind the scenes than we know.
But I think it may not be as big of a change as people were expecting when DiDio left. It may just be a more of a continue rolling on with a few things.
Or in, like, super positive land... He could come up with great ideas, and DanDio has been the one stifling him. I have no idea.
I don't see that happening.
I mean, again, I have to jump back to the Wildcats.
Yep. Yeah.
Damn it, Dave. Spartan is a great character. I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
If the headline read, creator of Wildcats now in charge of DC, very few people would be excited.
Bring on the wild covert action teams.
The wild covert action Batmans.
What are the stories we got?
Wild covert action Teen Titans. last story is Mark Ruffalo apparently is in talks to be on the She-Hulk TV show. This is great.
Yeah.
Even if it's just like a cameo in the first episode.
Yeah.
I mean, if they go with anything approaching the comics origin, he's got to be there. He's got to do a blood transfusion.
Which I feel like they are going to.
Yeah.
I've also heard that Alison Brie is... possibly in talks with doing as Jennifer Walters.
But not She-Hulk, right? That's weird.
I don't know. I don't know how they'd handle
Alison
that.
Alison Brie seems like a bad call for She-Hulk.
Really?
Yeah.
Everyone seems to love it.
I like Alison Brie. I don't think she'd make a good She-Hulk.
Isn't she, like, super good in Glow?
Or? She's great, but she's not She-Hulk. That's weird. I don't like that at all.
Well,
I don't think she's like I
don't have a strong opinion on this.
I don't
this.
Feel like Alison Brie would be a good call for She-Hulk. But we'll see.
It's interesting because at times Jennifer Walters, her alter ego, is at times kind of portrayed as like that was her meek side,
yeah.
And then she kind of got to be her true kind of more charismatic self as She-Hulk.
Yeah.
And then, but then usually over the years after that happened, whenever she's has turned back to Jennifer Walters, I think she's generally felt like she's still has that She-Hulk spirit.
Right. Right.
So I don't know what type of the version they'll be doing, but I can see a version of wherein Jennifer Walters is a kind of a quieter, meek character. Is that something Alison Brie could do?
Yes.
Yeah, that she could do.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. I'm happy to hear Mark Ruffalo's involved.
Yeah.
I love She-Hulk as a character, and you know, we've talked about this over the years. Like, sometimes people will wander in that are kind of civilians who don't know the comic biz, don't know superheroes very well, and they seem for years we would notice when they would see She-Hulk on the shelf, it just seemed endlessly amusing to them. They're like, "Now there's a She-Hulk."
Yeah.
Like ain't that the craziest thing? And I was like, "Man, She-Hulk has been a cool character since the 80s, at least. Maybe she was cool in the 70s.
Yeah.
She's been around since the 70s, actually created by Stan Lee.
Yeah.
The fact that she's kind of has a sense of humor, she broke a lot of stereotypes about the kind of what a female heroine could be.
Yep. She broke fourth walls.
She broke the fourth wall before Deadpool. Yeah, it's like her and Howard the Duck were leading the way back when. I wish the show well, and I hope it's going to be as cool as it could be. And Mark Ruffalo, playing off of Mark Ruffalo should be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Like,
I agree.
I hope he kind of guest spots. I like the idea of them being like cousins who can kind of like hang out a little bit, like who are buddies.
Well, if you take it from where Hulk is after Endgame, I mean, it's an interesting spot for Hulk. I mean,
where is he after Endgame?
I mean, he essentially brought everyone back. That kind of, however they want to run with that.
I would almost like, she could literally just be his lawyer. Although, I don't know, it's like, if you're a lawyer for your cousin, is it considered like a conflict of interest? Supposed to be representing your client as best you can, so I would assume you could represent a family member? I don't know how that works.
I don't know. I'm not a lawyer.
Well, if you are a lawyer, please write to us. Send us an email saying, I am
a
lawyer.
Or Russell, if you know the answer to this question.
Yeah, so you can take a shot. Don't look anything up, though.
It
has to be based
Russell's
on your... it has to be based on just what you know. Anyway.
All right.
I'm just saying she could be his lawyer.
I'm just thinking if I was your accountant.
Before she became She-Hulk.
All right. We'll be back in just a second to talk about comics for the week. We're talking comics for the week of Wednesday, March 4th, and this is a good week for me. I got a lot of stuff.
It was a weird week for me. I found myself liking some things, but not being pulled into many, which is why my pick when I get to it is kind of an odd one for me.
Also, we all picked number ones this week.
Yes, we did.
That's true. Did we not do that last week?
I don't know.
No, I had an X-book that was like number 7.
Yeah.
Nick always got to mess things up with X-books.
Hey, like what I like.
All right. Dave, why don't you start us off?
All right, sure. So, people know I am the biggest Tom King fan there is.
You're always talking about how much you love him shooting horses.
Oh, I forgot to mention, no, I actually mostly dislike Tom King.
Yeah.
But sometimes this is almost like this somewhat equates actually with the current direction on X-Men. I can look at it and say, there are some interesting things happening here.
Yeah.
This is drawing my attention. In a week, like, you know, when you've been reading comics as long as I have, sometimes you're a little bit immune to their charms. And this week, nothing was really grabbing me, but Tom King's first issue of Strange Adventures, a.k.a. his comic book about Adam Strange.
Yes.
In the tried and true format, he's working with, how do you say it?
Mitch Gerads.
Gerads and... Evan Shaner, I guess, is doing. He does the flashback sequences.
It's interesting because when you know that, you look through it and you can see it, but their art styles are similar enough. The approach.
I actually had not realized that. I thought it was all Mitch doing retro style.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is in the same format he's tended to do for quite some time now. A 12-issue miniseries. It is going to clearly be kind of one of those stories that's. What would you call it? Deconstructionist. It's going to take a sort of a Silver Age hero and find sort of something modern to look at and find in his story. It has sort of flashbacks to flashbacks that are kind of done in a retro style. Like if anybody read Mr. Miracle will somewhat recognize it, although it is different.
Yeah.
And stuff in the present day with he and his wife, which also made me think a little bit of Mr. Miracle. Yep. But it's very different vibe, and in fact, sort of the warmth that Mr. Miracle had, or at least at times had, certainly between he and his wife, yeah, Barda. I'm not sure I really see here, because they mostly talk about his career, right?
Yeah.
I think almost all their conversations are almost business-related.
Yep.
So, and indeed, the very first panel of it is Adam Strange doing, like, a book signing. So he's got a book in this that's literally called Strange Adventures. It's the cover of the book is the cover of the comic.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, like, saying, "Hi, I'm Adam. Can I sign a book for you?" Throughout the story, they kind of return to this book signing. You see what people are saying in the line and how they're reacting to him. Kind of some people fanboy out, some people kind of want to tell him that the book had something really meaningful that to them, kind of things you'd expect. And you know, as usual with the Tom King project, there's kind of a lot going on. Like I feel like almost some of this might be almost a little commentary on his own success.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where I'm sure, like a wide variety of fans, from fans that are like, "Oh, what a cool person," to fans that are like, found something really meaningful, and it seems a little bit like, "Wow, he's almost too into what I wrote," or whatever. Like, I imagine he's probably thinking some of those things. Interspersed with this, you've got a storyline where he's talking to his wife, whose name is...
Alana,
yeah. She's from Ran,
yep,
right?
Yeah, she is.
For people who don't know, he was like a Silver Age DC hero who was one of those kind of space heroes, a little like Buck Rogers, but who would periodically teleport. I guess this was more like... how John Carter would go to Mars periodically and have adventures. Yeah, that's probably what he's closest to.
He would get hit by a Zeta Beam and go to Ran and fight things, but...
have an adventure.
But, like, when those Zeta Beams, like, dissipated or something, he would go back to Earth.
Yeah. It's the ultimate fantasy for non-committal guys. You get zapped, you go off, you get to hang out with your girlfriend for a little while, you have an adventure where you kill some aliens, and then you're done and you can go back to Earth.
I mean, you're not wrong, and that kind of fits in with the story.
I'm joking. But
it's
that,
like an exchange program?
That may be end up being something about, like, that may be how he lenses it. Like,
yeah.
He's like, what is this, like, as a fantasy, as an archetype, as a concept, you know, not necessarily was DC trying to write about this back when, but were they tapping into some sort of, like, collective unconscious kind of thing about those ideas.
Adam
maybe.
Strange is the world shooting exchange student.
And so, but there is like sort of there's a direction that I'm at least sensing, even though this is just the first issue of 12. One thing is that you see some flashbacks to some of his adventures on Ran, and those ones are written, dialogued in what almost sounds like they could be taken from an old Silver Age comic or maybe a Bronze Age comic, where he's, you know, instead of being kind of a modern introspective character, he's like, you know, what do they call these aliens? It's a weird spelling, but it's like clearly based on the word Pict.
Yeah.
And he's like, "The Picts are, you know, overrunning the perimeter. You know, we've got to get the women to safety," and things like that. Kind of a, like, old school kind of patriarchal kind of vibe.
I was gonna say macho man.
Yeah, for sure. But there is, like, somebody who comes up in, like, one of the lines and, like, is talking about him like he is a war criminal.
Yep.
And the way he's blasting away at the alien hordes in this, mm-hmm, there's, like, certainly, like, a vibe that when you look back on it is like, oh, is this xenophobic? Is this a fantasy of, like, you know, gunning down the other? So you can see this is not a standard Silver Age story. And in fact, in a lot of ways, it's not the kind of story I usually like. I don't want something that's going to bring down this hero. I wouldn't mind finding something, you know, new ways to make him relevant. But this sounds like this could be too kind of a almost character damaging and too grim to lens. But it's interesting. And like, I couldn't look away. It was all the storytelling is like very sharply done. I found myself consistently interested. What were you about to say, Nick?
No, I mean, it delves into sort of, like, there's a murder mystery, and...
Yes. Right, somebody thinks that he may have, like, what, killed that rabid fan who like came up accusing him because that guy is like found dead the next day.
That's actually one of my favorite moments. there's a prominent DC guest star that gets involved there, and I thought the way they did that was interesting.
Yeah,
that was actually kind of unexpected because I sort of expected this to be
off on its own.
Yeah, off on its own. It is part of DC's Black Label line. Yep. Which, and it's not in the oversized format, so this is them branching out that a little bit, and I guess they had done that with, like, Curse of the White Knight or whatever.
I think this may be the first one that was actually planned as Black Label and then didn't come out in the big oversized format. Because they Curse of the White Knight, they just kind of moved it, and that's why it wasn't in that format.
But usually I expect him, when he's doing these projects, to kind of, for them to be under themselves and to not really involve much of the rest of the worlds of
Tom King usually doesn't. I mean, when he does these kind of prestige things, it's usually very self-contained.
But there's actually two characters in this that show up that are sort of notable DC characters, and did kind of make me interested to see what he's got to say. I'm always reminded of whenever I see somebody who's doing these sort of ambitious stories of when Grant Morrison first started writing New X-Men, and I was like, what? Cyclops is cheating on Jean with Emma Frost? What? You know, like, there's all this weird stuff going on. That felt like it was very untrue to them, even though I was like, well, that is actually one of the more interesting things that has ever been done with Cyclops, and like, I almost can buy it from this very repressed guy that, you know, Emma represents like a sort of freedom that he almost needs, and they and I kept going back to it. Now with Tom King, I have to confess, I don't know if I've actually ever read one of his stories to the bitter end to see if he wins me over. But most of the time I'm like, I don't want to see Vision deconstructed as a murderous spoof on suburbia. Vision and Scarlet Witch were some of my favorite characters growing up, and I want to see in some way a reflection of, like, I love the warmth that they have in the movies. Those have been awesome.
Yeah.
So anyway, but that said, this has my attention. You know what I'm going to maybe do is I think Mr. Miracle, of all the ones he's done, or maybe Vision, most has my interest, and I might go through and give it the full read.
I mean, if you want a recommendation that I think you'd enjoy, I think Mr. Miracle is the
you think
I think
one?
It's his best.
You know, I've read some issues of it, and I liked enough stuff in there that I've at times recommended an issue of that.
I don't think you'd like Vision. I think you,
I'd be too resistant to it.
I think so. I think since you like those characters so much, what he does with them is a little bit twisty. Too much.
Yeah. But this week, at least, I'm recommending issue 1 of 12 of Tom King's Strange Adventures. What do you guys got?
Nick?
I want to talk about Strange Academy. I know we mentioned this a couple weeks ago.
There's a theme of strangeness going on.
Yes. We talked about, they put kind of little snippets in the back of Marvel Comics from the past couple weeks.
Yep.
This is the first issue release, written by Scotty Young, art by Humberto Ramos. And I kind of fell in love with it from the first couple of pages.
Is this Hogwarts as run by Doctor Strange?
It's essential.
I mean, they make a reference to it when they recruit a kid.
Well, yeah, and it's not Doctor Strange. It's actually Brother Voodoo.
Oh, okay.
There's Dr. Voodoo.
He didn't go to medical school to be called Brother.
That's true.
He went to Brother School.
I did
He also has one of the most badass-looking designs that Humberto Ramos, with the kind of fur-lined black overcoat.
Yeah, it looks very dapper and cool.
Yeah.
What was I going to say? In the opening, a character is actually writing to Doctor Strange?
Yeah, it's a new character named Emily Bright. She's a young kid who has somehow tapped into magic.
Yes.
And since she was a little baby, I guess, has been kind of levitating and doing random things.
Things have been happening.
But there's a scene with her walking her dog, and something bad happens to her dog. And
she saves
it? And she saves it. And that sort of kind of causes things to snowball a little bit. And she writes to Doctor Strange.
Right. Well, she starts to realize it's very much anybody who knows anything about, like, I forget what they call it, but it's the kind of magic that is seen in the craft. And I don't know if this is, like, Wicca, like, in general, but, like, the idea that everything has a consequence.
Yeah.
Well, Jason Aaron.
Yeah,
Jason Aaron came in and did a big shift of Doctor Strange's price of magic and all that kind of thing. And it's sort of stuck.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, what he did and what Donny Cates did for Doctor Strange is sort of kind of stuck around.
So this girl, she's what, mid-teens or something?
She's
a little hard to tell
12.
With Ramos. It's hard to tell with Humberto Ramos characters because
he looks like a teenager.
He has a little bit of that anime style.
Yeah, 12, 13, somewhere in that ballpark.
But yeah, she's like dealing with some problems. She needs some help, and someone shows up.
Yes, if you read, she showed up in Jason Aaron's
Yes, she did. She was created for Jason Aaron's run. It's like his house
assistant. Her name is Zelma, I believe.
Zelma Stanton, I think.
Yeah, and she is sort of the person who comes to collect every kid to take them to magic school.
just a quick pause. There was I guess it was a woman named Zelda though. That Iceman used to date back in the day, in the '60s. That was his regular girlfriend.
Oh, really?
I just wanted to see if there was any chance he had repurposed an old Silver Age girlfriend into a character.
No.
Okay.
No.
Weird aside. Wholly, weird tangent. Yeah.
No, wholly new character.
So she shows up and is like, "You should come with me."
Yeah, and they go to New Orleans. Yeah, because that's where the school is.
That's where magic happens. That's where Marie Laveau is.
Yes, exactly. But yeah, no.
Actually, they don't name drop Marie Laveau, but they do suggest that New Orleans is where a lot of stuff is happening.
Yeah, it's a big kind of magic focal point. Lots of ley lines, I would assume. But yep. Yeah, and then from there, you're kind of given a rundown of some of the other students that are involved that are showing up.
They're all sort of arriving at the gates on day one.
There's a frost giant, which I thought was kind of cool. There's some Asgardians. Loki shows up because, Loki.
Well, Donny Cates brought Loki into the orbit in his run.
Yep. There's a fairy. There is a son of Dormammu kind of thing.
There's a ton of, I will say that Scotty Young tags every magic base here.
Yeah,
it's like Limbo is represented, Asgard is represented, Dormammu's Dark Dimension is represented, Fairy is represented.
And while we don't delve into too much of the characters, we're given a snippet of kind of what they are about.
It's a good establishing first issue. I would have liked the characters to be a little more strongly delineated.
Yeah.
But that said, I thought they did a really good job with this.
And we were kind of given a rundown of the campus and what things are and where things... It's very much we're getting introduced to the school. We are a,
Do they say anything about what the classes are?
They make a few oblique references to a few classes that they might be doing stuff like that.
They mentioned at some point since the place is in New Orleans and it's just built it's a larger on the inside kind of thing.
Sure.
One of them asks about it and Voodoo is it's just a basic space compression spell. You'll be learning about that later.
Okay.
There's definitely some references to, you're going to learn how to do all this cool stuff.
Okay, but they didn't say, there's potions class and there's this class.
No.
And
no.
Defense against the dark arts.
They'll do stuff similar, though. I mean, this definitely feels like someone's why on earth haven't we done a Harry Potter in the Marvel Universe?
Yep.
Well, it's just a good reason to get all the magic characters into one book. And I'm all for that. There's mindless ones kind of running around kind of as groundskeepers, and it feels very kind of larger than life.
The mindless ones specific, not just any mindless ones,
right, but the mindless ones from Doctor Strange. Yes.
Those are, the servitors of
Dormammu.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one of the things I really like about this, just as a concept, is that it feels when you play the Marvel games Ultimate Alliance, and it was do a tour of the Marvel Universe. This feels like a cool location to add to the Marvel Universe. If nothing else, the notion of this cool magic school in the center of New Orleans is a really neat idea, and it's brought to just stunning visual life. This is some of Humberto Ramos'
best. Yeah, it's great.
Art.
And that gives us a lot of its personality and kind of fun, is his artwork. But overall, and there's action in here as things occur on campus. It's just a fun idea and well-executed. I honestly am impressed with what Scotty Young did, because as much as I like Scotty Young's artwork, I've never felt that... I liked I Hate Fairyland.
But you're not really Middle West or...
Yeah, he does not usually do something that really impresses me. And this one, I felt like he had a good handle on these characters.
Yep. Nick, you're flipping around to the last page, and I see there's a faux, a mock student application for the Academy. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, yep. There's even a comparison questions, Doctor Strange's to... Nidavellir as Ice Crystals are to blank.
Interesting.
Just some fun ideas. And then I'm hoping it continues to be fun, which get to see these kids kind of explore the magic side of Marvel Universe.
Are any of the kids, is there anybody there who's a known character other than the teachers?
No, it all seems to be new characters. So
They have ties to things we know.
Right, I guess that's the deal.
I like the sort of, there's twins from Asgard and that kind of stuff.
But somebody asks him, do you know Thor? And
he's like, Thor's kind of a big deal. They're like, what about Odin?
And he's like, Asgard's a big place, guys.
Which I like that quite a bit.
I was impressed.
Alright, so my pick is also a number one. I think our theme this week is strange locations. Because this is Billionaire Island. It is a new series from Ahoy Comics. It is written by Mark Russell, who you may know from the Flintstones. His Okoye comics was Second Coming, where Jesus gets paired with a superhero.
Yeah, he does. He does satire primarily.
So satire with a social commentary.
Sharp perspective, yeah.
So this is about an island for billionaires. It is a 2044. It opens with this billionaire who is a social media guy, who's clearly meant to be a Facebook type guy,
yeah,
Zuckerberg, who bought into an agro business thing. And he's like, hey, billionaires, the world's getting rough out there for us because, you know, climate change is happening and people who can't afford our medicine are starting to suicide bomb us. And he's like, come to this island where only rich people live. And
he's like doing like a PR video for the island. Yeah.
And so it's basically like all the billionaires are going to this place where they can live while the rest of us die.
Right.
Which doesn't feel real at all. but the fly in the ointment is that there's a soldier who got caught up in this agribusiness thing, a social experiment they were doing that wound up killing his family, and now he is trying to track down these people. So it basically looks like we're setting up for vigilante justice against a bunch of billionaires.
Yep.
And if that sounds good to you, I think you're going to enjoy this.
And I imagine, knowing Mark Russell, that... Is it Mark Russell?
Yeah, it's Mark Russell.
I was like, not Mark Ruffalo.
Not Mark Ruffalo.
I'm sure there will be kind of like wheels within wheels and other twists and turns beyond the, like, let's hunt them. But the humor in this is pretty sharp throughout. And, like, almost a little bit pretty dark.
Oh, yeah. It is. I mean, like, the world building's fun. The character stuff is good. And, yeah, like you say, the sense of humor in here...
Well, they have, like, a thing with, like, where it's almost like, you know, when you walk through, like, a metal detector.
Right.
They have a thing that, like, it's like it, like... searches out your net worth, and if you're not like a millionaire, you don't get on the island.
Drones take you off the island.
Yeah, and it's in international territory, so everything is legal there, basically.
Yep. And this ties into like a reporter is following up a story, and she gets caught up in it, and yeah, it's got some people in here who are like under the billionaire's sway, and are like, no, we just need to figure out a way to function in this thing.
Right. He literally has them in a sort of a creepy giant hamster cage with like a giant water bottle. You have to press your face up against the thing to get water. Randy, there's nothing about this that's relevant to modern times.
No,
reminder,
no.
It's election day.
That is the only, when you hear the only this, problem with it. It's
I hope
so
you
hard
voted.
To believe.
Yes.
But yeah, tons of fun.
This is an interesting trio of books. They're all in some way... kind of pushing some interesting boundaries.
So, also on my list during this week, King of Nowhere, written by W. Maxwell Prince, illustrated by Tyler Jenkins, who I think was doing The Woods or Grass Kings, maybe?
Okay. Grass Kings, I think.
So this is a weird, like, a guy who thinks he's in a alcoholic LSD coma, wanders in his weird town, and soon finds out that, no, he's in a weird town.
You know, it reminds... It's a weird comparison in my brain, but I don't know if you've ever seen the movie U-Turn. It felt very much...
Yeah,
I can see that.
Yeah, Oliver Stone's
like
crazy movie.
Yes. Yeah.
That's a good movie.
It's a good first issue.
It really was.
To go from there. Outer Darkness 2 brings together two of John Layman's weirder properties. His food sci-fi book and his current demon sci-fi book. In a way that... it was good to see the two characters again. I didn't realize how much I missed them. And Outer Darkness, it actually ties it really well into it, so I'm looking forward to this. Also, looks like Layman may be bringing Chew back, so this is like a teaser for that. Some of my favorite Marvel books came out this week. Black Cat number 10 is the conclusion. By the way, two-parter. Love a good two-parter.
Yep.
We don't see it. Everybody's like, it's your eight-part now.
And Black Cat also has had like several what I would call standalone issues.
Yep.
But I also like, from somebody who's from the outside looking in, just sampling it occasionally, I can tell that they also tell part of a larger tapestry.
Yeah.
But there's a real art because I feel like they are genuine standalone issues.
Yep. And this is Black Cat and Wolverine teamed up in Madripoor for Capers, which is just super fun.
Yep.
Daredevil number 19 is also a two-parter, although it's picking up on Zdarsky's like 10-part story he's been doing. He's been building one big log run, which is what you do with Daredevil. That's what Brubaker did.
Right.
That's what Sewell did. That's what Bendis did.
Yeah, honestly, although I would enjoy, I'm sure, the occasional standalone story, and I think they probably all did at least some like that, the tapestry of Daredevil's life is kind of the important thing.
This is a big culmination as the super rich guys who are the villains have called in a variety of supervillains to basically tear down Hell's Kitchen. Including Bullseye.
Is Anna reading this book? Because
yes.
I feel like she needs to be reading that book.
Bullseye, Bullet, and Crossbones are among the crew that are like, and Rhino are all tearing their way through. And it's up to Daredevil, Cole North, his cop buddy, and the few incorruptible cops are not on the payroll to try and stop it. As well as there's some nice payoff to the citizens getting behind Daredevil as he's been on the way. There's also a huge reveal of what was a side character that I did not see coming because I didn't think it was anybody. I didn't think it was anybody. There's no reason to think there was a twist, but there's a great twist, and I'm like, oh, wow. These last two pages of this were like, this has been a consistently entertaining book, but these last two pages were one of those, oh, wow, what a great memorable moment.
Remind me again, Randy, is the first volume of Zdarsky's back in print?
Finally came back in stock, yes. Also, by the way, the artist on this, Julian Tatino Tedesco, check that out. That is gorgeous.
Yeah,
it is really beautiful
stuff. Yeah, that's pretty excellent.
This is a fantastic book. It is honestly, I think, one of the best books being published.
Yeah, now that it's back in print, I've been very much on my... That's been on my mind lately to catch up.
Mark Waid's Doctor Strange, which with issue 4 finally landed in the... Okay, I guess I'm a fan of this book.
Okay.
He's doing some fun stuff with Doctor Strange being a surgeon again. The head of his hospital is Dr. Anthony Ludgate, a.k.a. Dr. Druid.
Oh, nice.
They're doing some fun stuff with that, which I did not see coming.
That's cool. Dr. Druid is a character that was... kind of in a way the only mort during one of the most famous otherwise Avengers run that had the mansion siege and all that right around in that era, and I like the idea of rehabilitating characters. Randy, is he rehabilitating him, not just like throwing him to the wolves?
No, Wade's doing a great job with him.
Cool.
Spider-Man Noir number 1, which if you enjoyed the appointments of Nick Cage, this is actually a pretty straightforward world traveling pulp fiction Spider-Man Noir.
I really like the artwork.
I think they specifically, I just was flipping through it, but it looks like they made out that, like, with war pending, because it's, like, 1939, that's, like, kind of stepped up things, like does war have, like, a role in it? Like with Rocketeer, for instance.
Yeah, I mean,
it was
a
big part
of
that
country.
Okay.
So, and the writers specifically was asked to do a, like, they want to do a big, like, world-traveling thing. The artist, Nick, on this is Juan Ferreira, who did the Killmonger series.
Yeah.
There can't be enough Nazi punch in here.
I also hear Nicolas Cage when I read the voice.
I will say this. It's a little more played straight than I thought. No, they did not incorporate any of the Nicolas Cage.
I honestly would have thought that it feels like it fits in with all previous Spider-Man Noir comics. Yep. But that sense of humor, like a little bit of a dark sense of humor was a little bit integral.
Mirka Andolfo, who did the book Unnatural at Image,
is
back with her new book Mercy.
Yep.
It's
like a Victorian mystery, gothic
horror.
Horror mystery,
Marvel number 1, which is a new series of anthologies by Alex Ross and a bunch of different creators doing sort of painty tales of Marvel's past. And then Rescue 2020, which is a Pepper Potts one-shot. They're doing a lot of these 2020 one-shots. I really liked the Force Works last week, so wanted to give this one a look as well. Dave, what else is on your list?
Pepperidge Potts. I think you actually hit everything, except I just wanted to let people know that there's a big issue 750 of Flash with lots of cool multiple covers, just like the Wonder Woman 750 that hit a few weeks ago.
Yep.
And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, it's the culmination of like the big storyline that's been building in the comic for his entire run. Obviously, they jumped numbering to, 750 to a legacy numbering.
Yeah, right.
But I think this would otherwise be issue, 70 or something like that, right? But lots of other big creators on other side stories. I saw, who was the artist on Geoff Johns? Scott Collins is doing a story and all that.
That's cool.
And lastly, I did want to mention the collection that we have often talked about, the name we love to say, that now has a collection this week, Something is Killing the Children.
Something is Killing the Children.
Something is Killing the Children. This really is a very cool and book that is both creepy and kind of like has like a good suspense vibe to it. It is not as morose as it sounds, although it is dark. And I highly recommend it.
It's funny, for all that we've talked about, I still don't know what it's about at all, because I haven't touched it.
Well, so if I had to sum it up in just one word line...
Something is killing the children.
Yeah. Nick, you help me out here. The initial kid has, a dream? What he believes to be a dream? In which he finds, the dead bodies of his friends?
No, he... they're at a slumber party... telling tales, and he tells the tale of some sort of monster in the woods outside his house.
And then one of these kids, turns up dead.
Well, no. All of the kids at the...
all of them.
Except for him, are killed.
Yeah.
And, so it goes from there.
And there's, whatever this thing is, there's somebody who's hunting it, who even within the first issue or two, he connects with them.
And there's a war party at an Applebee's.
Really excellent scene.
Whatever this thing is, it's definitely killing the children.
Is this the thing that's killing the children?
Nick, anything else?
Yeah, I've got a couple. So, Marauders number 9, which I love that Jerry Dugan somehow has the same taste in movies that I do, because he's doing an Interspace riff.
Okay.
Utilizing the character of Yellowjacket living inside of Pyro.
It's
a sentence I would not typically say.
But to clarify for people who might think that he's like in a little gestation sack in him, or like
a
little embryo, he's in a little submarine, like an Interspace or Fantastic Voyage.
Sure.
If you're an older fella.
Yep. but it was an excellent issue. I love what they're doing with Bishop. The stuff they're doing with Emma Frost is very entertaining. Excalibur number 8 is the conclusion to the another two-parter.
Okay.
Which I do like seeing, of the X-Men hunting the werewolves.
I'm so happy they're using the werewolves again. I like the werewolves.
Yes. And incorporating the Bloodstones as a kind of a family to be reckoned with.
They're werewolves, not swarewolves.
That's true. Which I thought was good. I'm really enjoying the art on that one. There is a Superman villains special, which is sort of the villains reacting to Superman coming out as Clark Kent.
Oh, right.
I will say it's kind of a mixed bag, but there is the most excellent two-page comic strip of Lex Luthor finding out and getting kind of poked by the Joker a little bit. Like, I'm not going to spoil it, but it's legitimately great. It's Matt Fraction in sort of his...
I hope Luthor was like, this is some bullshit.
It's not far off from that. But that is all that I had.
All right. That's it for comics for us this week. We'll be back in just a second to talk about a movie. All right, so this week, the three of us went and saw a movie.
Yep.
But we didn't see anybody in it. Because the man was invisible.
Whoa! You know, prior to this, did y'all... I saw it at Draft House. Did y'all see the Draft House?
Saw the Draft House,
no,
yep.
I saw it at my local Cinemark.
Boo. All right, so you know how they show you a bunch of other, like, yeah, Invisible Man stuff beforehand? I was like, wow, the vast majority of Invisible stories prior to this have been El Stinko.
I've never seen one. I realized I'm watching it. I've never seen
it. Did you not see Memoirs of the Invisible Man, Chevy Chase?
I saw the trailer for it,
uh-huh,
and I remember him yelling, give me my molecules back, and I remember thinking, well, I don't want to see that shit.
Yeah.
That was Chevy Chase when he was trying briefly to become a dramatic actor.
Yep.
Daryl Hannah's the girl. It's so crazy.
Yeah, also, it is weird.
In watching the trailer, it's very much a noir trope. Like, he is talking like a detective, and he can do that to some extent. Fletch is like that, too. But he's such a goofball that it doesn't work.
It doesn't.
And so I'm like,
is there anything to recommend in the movie? Like, it's John Carpenter.
I forgot that.
You know, he did a few movies in the 80s that seemed a little bit off the beaten path for him. So also one of the other ones was, like, Starman.
Yeah.
His kind of upbeat, almost Spielbergian movie.
Yeah.
Starman is a really good movie.
I have not revisited it. I remember watching it once, and I don't remember it being like, this is the best movie ever.
Yeah.
So I
don't know that we need it to be the best movie ever.
The thing is it terrible?
I did notice that at the end when they're, like, trying to, like, bring him in or whatever, that they've got, like, heat signature, like, lenses and stuff. I was like, okay, they're thinking about some interesting things, even if the movie clearly is tongue-in-cheek.
I mean,
in a lot of
things. It could be there was a perfectly good script and direction, but Chevy Chase was the wrong guy for it.
Right.
I think that's entirely possible. But yeah, anyway, I had the same reaction, Dave. It's not sort of a, huh, I don't have Invisible Man's again. The only thing I remember Invisible Man is his role in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen as the pervert who gets...
really, he gets a bad end, aka the appropriate end.
Yeah, it is.
It's at 23% on Rotten Tomatoes. Not that, you know, Rotten Tomatoes.
The current one?
Not the current one.
No. The Memoirs of Invisible Man.
I will say, the original one with Claude Rains is a great, very watchable movie. This is one exception. There's a reason it's one of the beloved Universal Monster type movies. He's a great, crazy Invisible Man.
I was going to say, and Hollow Man is another one that was done.
Right. I think Hollow Man is...
if you want to watch Kevin Bacon go insane and start killing people, that's kind of fun.
Isn't the tradition of the Invisible Man in general that he is a... The trope of the Invisible Man story in particular is that it's someone who is depraved in some way and should not have this power.
Correct. I believe that is correct. Oh, there was one that at least was kind of cool where he was like... They clearly tried to make him hero back in one of these 40s movies where he's like a spy for the Allies.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, blowing up Nazis and stuff like that. Anyway, that part was kind of cool. But let's jump to our present movie where he is indeed another depraved man.
So by the way, 91% on Rotten Tomatoes right now.
Oh, yeah,
which is pretty good, especially for a horror movie.
I don't. I'm there's a rare case where I'm like, that might be too high based on my some thoughts I have on it.
Well, let's just go around.
So real quick, hot takes. I loved this, and I went and saw it with someone who she unfortunately has been through like gaslighting and abuse.
Yeah, and there's a lot of allegory and metaphor for that in this movie.
Not only allegory, I mean that's what it's about, but also straight up like gaslighting and abuse too.
Right.
Like,
sure.
And I was a little worried it was going to be triggery.
Yeah.
And I think for some people it could be. I think that's probably the biggest flaw is that. The kind of the people who would probably benefit from the catharsis of it also would have a hard time sitting through it.
Right. So you just might want to... That's something that's important to know going in.
But that said, if it's not so triggery you can't enjoy it, I thought as a suspense movie it was really effective.
Yeah.
I thought Elizabeth Moss was phenomenal playing against basically... Like, she has to look at someone who seems a little crazy, but we know she's not.
Yeah.
And I thought the special effects were well done. I thought the use of invisibility as a mode of terror was really good. I was very impressed with this. Nick?
I'm more on that side of things than that. I loved it. I will probably watch it again multiple times. But I also found the kind of suspenseness of it pretty terrifying. I mean...
Yeah, it's scary.
They utilize... I mean... What did this director do? I'm blanking on him.
Upgrade.
Right,
Lee, director.
And Lee Whannell is a frequent collaborator, or like, used to be a frequent collaborator of James Wan. He wrote Saw.
He wrote the original Saw.
He wrote all of the Insidious movies, that's I think.
Correct.
Literally every one of them. Yeah. And directed one of them, the third one.
He directed the third one.
Yeah, he wrote the third one.
And he recently, he did Upgrade, that sort of cyberpunk thriller movie, which is a pretty cool movie.
Okay, so... I like this guy.
Yeah.
I mean, just based on output.
Yep.
But the way he shot it and the sort of camera movements and things like that, it was very effective to kind of ramp up the tension to... I mean, it's not outright horror because we know that this is not a monster per se.
Right.
But, I mean, I got goosebumps in a lot of things where I could feel my adrenaline kind of like...
Whannell knows how to do suspense. He's like, because horror movies are suspense movies with monsters, basically.
Yeah.
Like, they're all about dragging out the tension of a scene. And this is one of those ones where there are these really, really terrifying scenes where she has, even before, when she actually figures it out earlier on than I thought, and we'll talk about plot in a minute, but of her walking down, like, hallways in, like, a dimly lit house with a strong sense that something is in the house. She's even started to maybe even guess it, that this could be her creepy, abusive husband or boyfriend.
I believe husband.
I was thinking it wasn't. Oh, yeah. I don't know.
Was it her
husband?
I thought it was her husband.
Yeah. I guess I thought so too.
But
then somebody corrected me on that, and I never was new for sure. Anyway, be that as may, the tension is they drag out the tension so that your nerves will get all frayed watching this, and the Whannell knows how to do that. Where I had an issue was I was like it's kind of exploitive. It felt like to me like it's a little trashy. I thought yes, clearly we're on her side, but like it kind of turns it into a. I don't know, a thrill, suspense ride thriller about something that's, like, clearly very real and kind of painful.
Yeah.
And I thought it was, like, almost maybe a little too close to home. And I again, I'm saying this is, like, somebody who hasn't, like, experienced it per se, but it kind of, I felt a little gross at times.
Oh. I never got to that feeling. I understand. I'm not going to say that that's wrong or to feel that way. I never felt that it was trashy.
You know, part of it was also that I think a few of the things were a little tropey. The good guy cop husband, or like her, is it? How did she get connected with the guy who's the cop who she stays with?
He seems to be a friend of her sister.
I thought they grew up together.
Did they? I didn't get that. I got the sense that she was a friend of her sister and that they became close when she moved in with him.
Oh, I thought there was some line that said, that we grew up together or something like that.
Oh, it's possible. I just didn't catch it.
But he's a little bit of almost like the cliched next door neighbor in these movies. Have you ever seen like Single White Female or whatever? There's usually some good guy who's the, I hope that person can get to them in time in some of the big scenes of peril.
By the way, this guy is Aldous Hodge.
Yeah.
Who I know from playing the hacker on Leverage.
Yeah, Hardison.
Yeah.
And it's crazy to see him like this buff cop in here. It was crazy.
Yeah.
He's great. He's really good in the role.
Yeah.
He's a natural at it. I had somebody point out to me, it's like, he doesn't believe her early on, and I'm like, it is a little weird to have as the coming to your defense cop, given like the high rates of abuse among cops. It's just a little weird.
When you're given the thing that you've seen pictures of his body,
yeah.
They've pronounced him dead. And
no, yeah. I think Dave's just saying there. Oh. Dave, you and I may have a higher percentage of people in our life who are like, no cops ever in any media.
That's possible. No, so let's go ahead and like, we haven't said like sort of what the basic plot is. So, and it gets going pretty fast.
Yeah. So basically, this is a woman who has been in an abusive relationship, who finally gets out.
And he's a super wealthy guy.
With a super wealthy guy. She gets out, and then the guy seems to be dead, but she starts thinking that he is, in fact, alive and has become invisible and is stalking her.
Right.
And no one believes her. They just think she's having, because she does have, you know, she has mental issues from the abuse.
Yeah.
And she was off her meds for a little bit, and so... What I was surprised by the story was I thought maybe that they would do an unreliable narrative for the viewer, where we weren't sure what was actually happening.
Right.
But no, we're on her side from the beginning. Like, we know. But
here's the particular nature of his mental torture is that she actually is supposed to get this big $5 million payment for like insurance thing from mm-hmm. it. Or no, it's just in his will.
Mm-hmm.
But there has to, with a few stipulations about she has to like pass a basic mental health screening thing and not have committed any crimes. And he's immediately looking to break her down with these things. And, like, they showed that in the trailer, and I was like, oh, I bet, like, about, like, most of this movie is going to be her not even knowing he's doing little secret messed up things. But she is actually suspicious almost from the get-go that it's him.
Beginning.
Yeah. And I appreciated that because, it was like, just dramatically it felt sound to not make her be dumb, you know?
So, the person I went with said this after we left. She was talking about this was a perfect... It's a perfect metaphor for gaslighting and abuse.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that as well, but I'm like, my baseline is just from having read and seen.
Right.
She's someone who's lived through it, and so I feel like that I can say a little bit that yeah, this is like no one believes her, and the abuse is never when anyone else is around, and
right.
So everyone just sees this like, well, she's acting crazy. He must be fine, and she's the crazy one, and
right.
You know, the how trapped she feels. How she can't get anyone to believe her, and therefore she can't escape it. Like, it's
right.
Such a...
She also talks at one point about how it was, like, sort of slow to happen,
mm-hmm.
Like, where he would, like, first control, like, you know, what she would eat, and
mm-hmm.
then, like, sort of what she would wear, and then how she would think, and that, like, you can see her desperation in the opening. She's, like, trying to get out of his place. She's got, like, her go bag
mm-hmm.
sort of packed up.
Mm-hmm.
It's a super tense
Man,
sequence.
That opening scene is so...
Yeah.
It's as tense as anything from, like, First Quiet Place. Like, it's
yeah.
really tense.
If you... and also, if you're at the Alamo and you've got some chicken strips you want to eat, and you're like, I know that if I eat this, it's going to... This sound will explode across the theater.
Yeah,
and I'm like, well, I'm just going to wait for the scene to wrap. But it's like a 10-minute opening scene or maybe a little bit more.
Yeah.
But anyway, it is a really good opening scene.
Yeah, they have you gripped into your chair from the very beginning.
Well, I think it's really smart to basically flip the story and focus on the victim as opposed to focusing on the person who has the power.
Yeah, there's no, like, big scene of how he discovered invisibility. They show how he does it.
Yeah.
But there's no big scene of, like, here's him testing it out. We just see as she's escaping. We see some kind of high-tech lab. And then suddenly he's doing it, and
yeah.
I thought they did a good job with that.
Yeah, the actual reveal of it, like, within cinematic terms, like, I don't want to quite just reveal
right,
everything,
right.
But within cinematic terms, it seems believable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're like, oh, yeah, this kind of looks like something that I can buy for purposes of, like, this story, at least.
And, by the way, while it is very, very suspenseful and,
uh-huh.
and spooky, and a lot of it is sort of low-level horror, it's like one person with one
yeah.
person... when it goes into, like, a full-on action mode in, like, the third act,
yeah.
it's very effective and very scary.
Yeah, the effects
yeah.
were good.
What I was wondering about, and this is, you know, I also have not been in a position of having, like, been gaslit per se, but...
I'm trying to gaslight you every day at work.
I know. I know. No, is I wondered if the ending wall would bring catharsis of some sorts, or whether it would be kind of like... You would think more about, like, the unpleasant aspects of the movie and the, you know, like, maybe sort of getting out from under his reach would not be enough.
I see that, and I think there's an argument to be made. I thought the ending was note perfect. I thought it was exactly the ending I wanted.
Interesting. I think Lee Whannell is a guy who's, like, a pretty expert craftsman.
Yeah.
I think he's occasionally a little bit tropey. But, like, a lot of times he's doing something unexpected. I have to say, there are some great scares in the movie, and the one where she's in the attic, and if you know the scene I'm talking about,
yeah.
it's where
yep.
she's peering down the ladder.
Yeah.
What happens after that, like, freaked me the fuck out.
Yeah. That scene was one of those tense ones, but it's also, that's the one scene in the movie where I was like, what are you doing? Like, most of this, I'm like, okay, no, I see this. I understand why you're doing the things you're doing. This, I'm like, what are you doing? You know this. You at this point, you are pretty certain of what's going on. Why are you going up there? This does not seem like a thing you should be doing right now.
Well, one of the interesting things was, like, the first time that she starts to think it, and, like, people are not sure, she, like, throws these coffee grounds all over the floor looking for foot to wait to see if he approaches her in the room and leaves footprints. And they actually use it pretty cleverly where, as a narrative tool, while she's sitting there and kind of in despair alone at this point, she calls out to him and she's, like, talking. And you actually get some good exposition that gives you what's going on in her head by that. And, like, it's just good writing craftsmanship.
Yeah, I think one of the things about her performance in general, and not just performance, but the script, obviously, is that she doesn't just cower the whole time.
Right, like, she is actually actively thinking and through stuff.
And, like, the fact that she yells at him numerous times, she's like, just kill me if this is what you want. Like, she is basically, like, not willing to just be terrorized. She is trying to fight back as well as she can.
I wonder if, I mean, not to knock the movie in general, but would this work as well as it does if it wasn't Elizabeth Moss?
I do think there's a lot of it has to do with Elizabeth Moss.
She is an amazing actress and conveys kind of a level of sincerity to it.
You know, I think, I'll say this. I think it's a pretty strong script, and that there are a lot of really great actresses out there, and they would have brought something different to the table, and I think she was best casting possible. So I don't think, like, I can't take away too much from the movie because they cast it so well. Like, if they hadn't cast it so well, it would have been, like, you know, knocked down a peg or two. I mean, they did cast it well, so they should get credit for that. But, like, there's a lot that I guess I'd say he does get away with. There's some pretty bad things. There's some high collateral damage in this. And that is the part that left me thinking, I'm like, I'm almost a little more disturbed by what he did get away with than what he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
The craft is inescapable. I don't know that I would go back and watch it in particular, though.
I'm not sure I would either, but I don't tend to rewatch horror movies, even really good
Interesting.
Ones.
Interesting.
I've heard, like, snippets from 1L about kind of why he made this, and because he doesn't typically, this wasn't something on his radar to do. So I'd be curious to see what, like, special features and stuff pops up on the release.
Sure. I mean, this is the kind of thing that seems like the behind the scenes and the, you know, actors talking about their roles and stuff like that could yield some interesting commentary.
All right, Nick, you and I want to talk about, there's a Netflix show that came on, Altered Carbon ran, but at the same time they put a new show called I Am Not Okay With This.
Yeah.
Which is a 7-episode, 30-minute episodes.
Some of them aren't even 30 minutes.
Yeah, it's a short one. It's a quick run-through. It's a quick binge. But it is based on a graphic novel, an indie graphic novel, which I have not read.
Nope, I haven't either.
It stars the girl who played the young Beverly in It.
And also the Stanley from It as well.
Is that... Oh, he's from It as well?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it is about a young girl who discovers she has telekinetic powers.
Yep.
And that maybe she's a lesbian.
Yep.
And her sort of trials and tribulations. And her father died. Her mom is a stressed single mom. She's got a brother. And she's basically just kind of... And so there's a lot of fourth wall breaking as she talks into her diary. And she talks directly to us, basically.
Yeah.
This was fun. It's dark, but it's got a... it's got a light energy.
Yeah, it is dark, but I never felt like it kind of mired in the darkness.
No.
It's there, and it's dealing with pretty big ideas.
Yeah.
And
it's by the director of End of the Fucking World.
Yeah,
which was also an indie graphic novel, and I like that one quite a bit. It has a similar energy.
Okay, I haven't watched that one, but I like that, you know, she's dealing with her father's death and how that happened, and dealing with trying to figure out herself and the relationships. They all feel very organic and real. I love the relationship with her best friend and with the guy from It.
Stanley's a great character.
Yeah.
I love that character. He is the awkward, nerdy guy I wish I was in high school.
Yeah. But even
not the awkward, nerdy guy I was.
But he's even given a lot of screen time, especially with, like, his relationship with his father and how that sort of mirrors the relationship that she is having with her family as well. It just surprised me.
Yeah, me too. Good character stuff. Like, the telekinetic angle, it is a important part of it.
Yeah.
But it's definitely not just that. It is a character-driven, like, dark comedy coming of age drama?
Her kind of figuring out her powers and randomly doing it and trying to convince herself that that wasn't her.
Yeah.
Leads to some very humorous things.
It feels very on brand for Netflix. So I've been watching a lot of the stuff on Hulu lately.
Yeah.
And there were a couple Hulu shows where I'm like, this feels like CW stuff. This feels like a Netflix show. It doesn't feel like a CW Teenager with Powers thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely worth a look. And at some point the graphic novel will come back in and we'll see if that's worth a look.
Yeah.
All right, that'll wrap it up for us this week. We'll be back next week with more. Until that time,
Yo, Joe!
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.